is the SF Signal Podcast, number 10, powered by the Functional Nerds. My name is Patrick Hester. I am an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd. And tonight, I am joined by several of the folks who bring us SF Signal each and every week. Let's introduce everybody, and starting in no particular order, but because it's his first show, he gets to go first, Mr. Fred Kish.
Hi, this is Fred Kish. I blog at a website called The Lensman's Children, which is also found at The Eternal Golden Braid. Just do a search for The Lensman's Children, and you'll find me. And I'm an occasional contributor to SF Signal.
And it's awesome to have you on tonight, Fred. Welcome.
Now, thanks to the awesome technical ability of the Functional Nerds.
And second up tonight, we have Mr. Jeff Patterson.
Hi, this is Jeff, writer, illustrator, blogger. I can be found at Gravity Lens, which is at baddaystudio.com. And now that you know this, I must destroy you all.
Third up, Mr. John DiNardo.
How you doing? This is John D. from SF Signal and resident blogger.
And
that's it.
And last tonight, but certainly not least, Mr. John Anilio.
Hey, I'm John. I write songs about science fiction and fantasy. You can get a lot of my stuff for free at johnanilio.bandcamp.com. I also do a video blog for Wired.com's Geek Dad blog called Geek Dad Guitar Lessons. And you can follow me at Twitter at twitter.com/johnanilio.
Awesome. And thanks, everybody, for being on tonight. Our topic is, are the days of the white hat hero and the goatee-wearing villain in science fiction and fantasy gone forever? More and more in science fiction, fantasy, and heck, all across the genre spectrum, we see what are considered to be the morally ambiguous characters, the anti-heroes who do the right thing, but only because it falls in line with what they were going to do anyway. Or maybe they did it because they saw a way to capitalize on it later. They drink to excess, they smoke, they do drugs, they have rampant sex with anybody that'll have it sex with them, and sometimes even people who won't. They fight a lot, they kill people, the list goes on and on and on. Characters with flaws as wide and deep as the Grand Canyon have become far more mainstream in literature, film, and TV. So the question is, are the days of quote-unquote real good against quote-unquote real evil gone?
Patrick, you know, before we start, are we talking about Jeff Patterson here, or who are we talking about?
I was about to say, I'm very, very insulted by this.
Well, then, Jeff, why don't you start this off? What do you think?
Well, the hero-villain thing, a lot of thoughts come through my head. I mean, I think about it, when I think about villains, one that always pops up to me as not necessarily being morally ambiguous, but having a very clear mission always, is Dr. Doom, because Dr. Doom clearly wants to make the world a better place, provided it's under his rule. But when you're dealing with moral ambiguity, the scotch is kicking in, pardon me. one of the things that comes that I started thinking about was the Uplift books by David Brin, wherein a lot of the time the villainy, the races that are the bad guys in it, are not acting out of villainy. They're acting out of a moral imperative based on their alien nature, based on their biology or based on the philosophies that have developed because of whatever social system that they work in. To bring that down to a strictly human hero-villain character, in an attempt to define it, to put it shortly, pardon me here, one of the things that I keep coming back to is most of the times villains in science fiction books have to stand up to a pretty high standard, unless you're talking about, you know, the obvious things like Star Wars and stuff like that, where it's always going to be, it's not even an allegory for good versus evil. It is actually good versus evil. When you're dealing with most of the hard science fiction and even a lot of space operas and stuff like that, the newer stuff, villains have to have a pretty well-defined set of terms, a set of goals, you know, whatever their own morality is, et cetera. They have to be standing up for what they believe in. It just happens to go against what the protagonist is doing. As for the anti-hero itself, we've kind of always seen that. You know, I was thinking about, you know, the scoundrel and the rogue are just great tropes in science fiction that have always been there. The cigar smoking space pilot and stuff like that. And yes, they always tend to have a heart of gold, but I think they definitely planted the seed for the type of character you were describing.
Fred, what do you think? What's your take?
Well, working backwards, I mean, the anti-hero has always been around and has never gone away. If you look back to C.L. Moore with Northwest Smith, her stories, I mean, you had Han Solo's grandfather. I personally happen to love space opera. I don't think it ever went away. The new space opera is just the old space opera with a, you know, using Macs or PCs. So, I mean, I still call down Doc Smith and Jack Williamson and World Wrecker Hamilton and all those other guys every year or so and reread them. And I love villains that are black and white or heroes that are white and black. The morally ambiguous character is becoming more interesting, I think, when handled with a good writer. Like I'm just reading right now Glenn Cook's Black Company series.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a mercenary unit, so you've got a very morally ambiguous group of heroes, but the group that they're fighting initially, which are sort of like these fallen angels or uplifted wizards,
right,
including one called the Lady. I mean, they start out being the quote-unquote bad guys, but they end up, the Black Company ends up working for them. And by the, I think, the fourth book or the fifth book, the Lady is the main character. And, you know, they've all got common goals of basically trying to escape the situation of the first couple of books.
Right. So is this just part of the natural evolution of the genre? What do you think, John?
To answer the question, I don't know about the evolution thing, but to answer the question of is it gone? I don't think anything's gone forever. Things come back. So, and who said it? Was it Jeff that said, you know, they haven't really gone away?
If Marvel Comics and DC Comics have taught us anything, it's that nothing ever dies or goes away.
Which is another good point that Jeff brought up. Comic book villains are, you know, generally pure evil, right? It's the guy with the evil plot to take over the world or destroy the world, or, you know, he's got the evil henchmen. He's got the setup, man. He's got the whole thing. There's no moral ambiguity in lots of comic book villains, at least the classic ones.
But you know, he pointed out Dr. Doom. Well, you also have, like, Lex Luthor. And as far as Lex Luthor's concerned, he is doing everything he can to protect the Earth from aliens.
That's correct. And Magneto is looking to make the world safe for mutants. And a lot of the villains, the A-list villains, all have a pretty distinct, especially, you know, in the last 10, 20 years when as comics have matured, you've seen a lot more of this. You know, a lot of your Spider-Man villains are just basically petty crooks who happen to grow wings or turn into sand, you know, so.
I think I need to read up on comics more then.
Yes, you should.
I'm thinking back, too, to like the early days of sci-fi when, you know, the pulps of the 30s and 40s when it did seem more like the, you know, the rootin' tootin' hero, you know, it was like cowboys and Indians, right, kind of thing. It was, you know, there were clear heroes and villains.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up because I was even thinking when I was writing this topic and kind of sending it out, I kept coming back to Clint Eastwood and the westerns that he did.
Hmm.
You know, because you have like the Outlaw Josie Wales, you have all these movies that he made, High Plains Drifter, where, you know, he's sort of supposed to be the bad guy, but really he's the one that ends up protecting people and going after the bad guys.
And maybe there is an evolution where that's kind of hard to find these days. Maybe a recent example too, Space Vulture by Gary K. Wolf and John Myers.
Yeah,
is a throwback, an excellently done throwback to those old pulps with good guys versus bad guys, and very wholesome too, right? It was, you know, it was written to be to be wholesome. Myers is an archbishop, and it was, you know, intended to be that way. And it was just a really, really fantastic read, and it was just very good. It was just very well done.
John, you've been sitting there quietly, almost as if you were a gold farmer for World of Warcraft. What's your take on this?
Well, I don't think it's anything new. I think this sort of anti-hero or a morally ambiguous hero has been around for a very long time. I mean, we had James Eng on Functional Nerds this week, and his character.
Whoa, no cross advertising, please. No, just kidding.
I was sitting there thinking, dang, good plug.
Yeah. Well, I was trying to plug, but no, we had James Eng on the Functional Nerds podcast, and anyway, his main character is Morlock, and he writes Sword and Sorcery, James, and I mean, that's by definition, that's what Sword and Sorcery is. It's essentially a morally ambiguous character. We've talked about that before on this podcast, and I just read his Blood of Ambrose book this past week, and you know, his main character, I mean, they always end up doing the right thing. I think a lot of times what we think about in this moral ambiguity is that I think it's sort of a conviction of doing what needs to be done. And there are many instances in the Blood of Ambrose where Morlock will do something that's sort of horrific or gruesome, which is, I think, is sort of the case in a lot of Sword and Sorcery, where you know, it's a hero wouldn't do that, but when someone needs to get the job done, or as my wife will talk about a lot of times, if you watch these cop shows, you know, there'll be a cop going, "I got a job to do," you know, they always talk about their job that they have to do. And but I think, you know, most heroes are kind of like that these days. I think it's hard to find one that's not. And you know, as Jeff, I believe, wrote in the emails about letting go of Star Wars, I mean, Han Solo is one of the earliest characters in my, you know, but obviously Han Solo is, that's good. That's a good background. Keep that going. But Han Solo is somebody that, you know, from the time that I'm a really little kid is pretty present in my life. And, you know, he's sort of the template for the rogue hero. And then later on you have Joss Whedon doing, you know, Malcolm Reynolds, and essentially doing a Han Solo type character where, you know, he shoots somebody without really even hesitating at all, then whether that person should have been shot or not. And, you know, so I think this type of hero has been around for a long time. And to make another point about that, have you guys, any of you guys read any of Chuck Klosterman's books?
No, anybody? I haven't.
Nope.
He is not a sci-fi author. He's a guy in his sort of late 30s, and he's written about four or five books at this point, and they're all sort of collections of essays. And, you know, he has one called Fargo Rock City, and his best book, in my opinion, is called Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, which if you're over 35, you know, if you're between like 35 and 40, or 35 and 45, you should read this book, because he does a lot of really interesting essays. And if you meet somebody I'm 36. If you meet somebody my age and they talk about Star Wars, they'll always say like, "Oh, Han Solo was always my favorite," which is kind of bullshit, because when you're, you know, when you're like 6 or 7 years old, Han Solo was not your favorite. Luke was everybody's favorite, you know. It's not until you become older that Han becomes appealing to you.
It's trendy. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I love Han now, but like as a kid, I totally identified with Luke. You know, yeah. I had blonde hair as a kid too, so I don't know if that was part of it, but you know, Luke is good. And as a 6-year-old, you understand that. Han, you don't understand. You just think Han's kind of funny and cool, but you don't necessarily aspire to be Han as a 6-year-old. Luke makes more sense to you. And he's got, so for that alone, he has a whole 10-page essay on how we all wanted to be Luke, but we don't admit it. It's totally worth reading just for that. He has a lot of other cool essays in that one, extensively about Saved by the Bell, that show. So that's definitely worth reading. You should all go read that book. But the Han Luke parallels is very interesting.
Gotcha. Now, one of the other points that I made in the email was that, you know, science fiction has always provided a platform for complex social topics and taboos, you know, to be essentially safely explored through the eyes of aliens or you know, as contrast with alien worlds and against human cultures. Is this just another step forward? I mean, as a society, are we just kind of putting these things in our stories to see, you know, to kind of test the waters, and then maybe that's how our society is going to change? I mean, are I guess I'm saying, are our morals kind of shifting? Is our compass shifting? What do you think, Fred?
Well, I think, at least for me, science fiction introduced me to alternative lifestyles or alternative ways of thinking. I mean, even associated stuff, if you've ever read Samuel Delaney's autobiography, The Motion of Light and the Water.
Yep.
He talks, there's this one description in there where he talks about this massive group growth in downtown New York, which is, if you look at the post-AIDS society that we live in now, is as strange as an alien planet full of, you know, giant flying octopi or something. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, my first description of the act of sex was a Robert Silverberg novel. You know, even before Robert Heinlein, although Heinlein always gets the blame with most fans.
And that was so, last week's topic.
Yeah,
it was. But as far as, you know, different races, science fiction was in growing up in the white bread community that I lived in. You know, the first authors I read who were black were science fiction writers. Many of the first authors I read that were women were science fiction writers, whether they admitted to be women or not, like James Tiptree, a.k.a., you know, Alan Sheldon, Joanna Russ. Anybody who pretty much wrote for that series called Orbit, that Damon Knight came out with a new installment like every year. The Nebula Awards all through the 60s, through the early 70s, all was full of stuff that you didn't come into contact in northeastern Jersey.
Well, and see, it's almost like it offers like the stepping point. You know, it's kind of like here's the beginning, and then from science fiction and fantasy, it kind of moves off into other genres, and before you know it, it's not taboo anymore.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I wanted to say is, you know, it's last week, I wasn't on the podcast last week, but I listened to it, and I remember wanting to jump in with this, and I'm like, oh, I wasn't on this one, so you're not going to hear my voice here. But the point that I wanted to make was, I was a late reader in terms of reading for my own pleasure. I was a good student, but I didn't really, my parents weren't big readers. I didn't read a lot as a kid. It wasn't really until I was an adult that I started reading. But I remember, I think one of the biggest selling points on reading and reading science fiction in particular, but reading in general, is that, you know, they curse in books, and there's like graphic sex in books, and there's graphic violence in books, and it's okay. You know, so to me, that's the biggest selling point to a kid about reading, is that, you know, you have like these really adult themes that are not watered down at all. And if anything, we as adults are encouraging younger people to read, even though there is graphic sex and graphic. And I think that's great. But I think it's something that I remember the first time reading something, maybe as a teenager, and thinking like, oh, my God, I can't believe they're talking about this in here. Like, this would be so dirty if it was a movie, but it's a book, so it's okay. So,
yep.
One thing I like to point out about science fiction readers is that at least when, I forget when it came out, like 69 or thereabouts, was Alvin Toffler's Future Shock.
Yeah.
And, I mean, which went through a gazillion printings. And, of course, it was that the pace of change is increasing faster and faster, and at some point we're all going to walk around like a bunch of mind-numbed idiots because we just can't keep up with it anymore. And discussing this with some people once, they asked me if I felt this way. I'm like, well, no, you know, cloning, you know, I've read about that for years. You know, communications, I've read about that for years. Computers, no problem. I think science fiction educates you so you live in the future better than many of your fellow members of society.
let's take a pause for just a second here. Karen Burnham wants to come on, so we're going to add her in really quick. Hi, Karen. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Patrick. How's it going?
Good. Tell everybody who you are real quick.
I am Karen Burnham. I vocationally am an engineer for NASA, working with cool things like electric equipment on the space station and pyrotechnics. And avocationally, I review, speculative fiction.
It's been a long day. I think I asked you once before about Wolowitz on the Big Bang Theory.
Oh, yeah.
He on the season opener, he snuck a mechanical arm out of the JPL lab to play with it.
You made that sound so dirty.
It was. But he when they asked him about it, he said, "You just have to walk like you own it." Anyway, tonight we're talking about morally ambiguous characters in science fiction, and obviously you wanted to join in on the conversation. So, what's your take on all this?
Well, coming in completely cold, having no clue what anyone else has said, I'd say they're a good thing. Moral ambiguity is a good thing. I think that moral absolutes were great up through World War II, and you could say, "Hey, we're the good guys, and they're the bad guys, and it's nice and easy." I think the Cold War and everything that's come since has sort of disillusioned us of that, you know, rather naive view of the world. While it's kind of depressing, I can't bring myself to think it's a bad thing, especially because in the days when we thought there was just good and evil, and we thought we were good and they were evil, we still did a lot of evil stuff. So hopefully if there's a little more nuance, people will, you know, not be so ready to excuse some of the bad things that we do in the name of, you know, justice, truth, justice in the American way.
What are some examples of characters, novels, authors that stand out in your mind? Fred has just been regaling us with all kinds of really cool stuff. And I'm sorry you missed that out on that. And I almost wanted to call it the Fred and Jeff show. And just turn them loose, because it was fantastic stuff.
I don't think I can compete with that.
Sure you can. Sure you can. I mean, what are some examples of stories and characters and novels that stand out for you?
Okay, the one that just jumped to mind right off the bat, Richard Morgan. All of his characters are ambiguous, to say the best. I've still got my doubts about Takeshi Kovacs in general, which side of that good-evil line he actually falls on. And then, of course, there's sort of the genre's number one unreliable narrator, Severian, from the brilliantly written Book of the New Sun, the four books that are Book of the New Sun by Gene Wolfe. He does all sorts of stuff. I mean, he just runs around, and it's all from his own point of view. So from his own point of view, everything he does is great.
Exactly. Yeah. We kind of talked a little bit about that. Usually the villain doesn't think that they're necessarily doing anything wrong. You know, Lex Luthor is protecting Earth from aliens.
Right.
Patrick, can a crusty old guy address something she said there real quick?
Yes. You meant you. Oh, sure.
Yes, I meant me. I have a couple of crusty guys here right now. I don't want to take her to task, but she sort of said that we no longer live in a world of moral absolutes, rather blithely. And I think that needs a little bit of qualification. And the reason I say that is because, especially in the world of fiction, most of the characters, you know, we were talking about villains before, and even some of the worst villains that you have a pretty clear moral code that they're going by. And I think this holds true with a lot of, you know, heroes as well. And I'm not just talking about, you know, Doc Savage and characters like that. However, I do feel that Commander McBragg is the paragon of humanity personally. but at the same time, I'm kind of fascinated with the idea of the morally ambiguous anti-hero as a lifestyle choice, which was kind of brought up earlier before. I can just picture, you know, these kids, you know, slowly turning into charming rogues, et cetera, you know, and the parents wondering where they went wrong.
Never should have let him watch Star Wars. Never. Fred, did you have something you were trying to say too?
No, I was just wondering which of us is the crustiest. I mean, I heard a 56-year-old mention that.
Well, obviously, DiNardo. I mean, hands down.
Oh, that goes without saying. But let's say it anyway.
Have you passed the half-century mark for Mr. DiNardo?
What's that? You were cutting out there.
Have you passed the half-century mark yet?
Not yet.
Well, I'm 2 years away.
I've beat you by two years past that. So.
And how was that colonoscopy?
Check, please.
I think that's a good spot to wrap it up.
Oh. Seriously, you guys are so good for my ego. All of a sudden, I feel young.
Yeah. Wow.
How can you not?
Yeah.
How can you not? Okay. Well, I think John's right. I think it's time to wrap this up. Thanks to everybody for coming on. Silence.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Whatever.
Sorry for being late.
John and Neil, you for the win.
you weren't late, Karen. You just made a fashionable entrance.
And you schooled us all. Although what I said pretty much was what you said. So.
Okay. Good.
And for our listeners, this week's interview is a young whippersnapper named Sam Sykes.
Yes.
So stay tuned for that. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.
And if you'd like to be a part of the conversation, we now have a SF Signal voicemail line. You can call 720-277-9082 and leave us a voicemail about this topic or any other topics that we've covered here on SF Signal on the podcast. You can also shoot us an email, or if you want to record like an MP3 and email that to us, you can do that as well. And you can send that to voicemail@sfsignal.com. And welcome to the interview portion of tonight's SF Signal podcast. I have with me from SF Signal, John Ottinger III and Mr. Aiden Moore. John, why don't you say hello?
Hello, how are y'all?
You also write over at Grasping for the Wind, obviously.
Yes,
and,
way too much.
And Aiden, you are new to SF Signal, but you also have a Dribble of Ink.
Yeah, that's me, Dribble of Ink. I've been running that for a few years, but I'm brand new to that SF Signal, so I'm glad to join you guys tonight.
Very cool. And we are gathered tonight to give Sam Sykes a really hard time.
Well, now hold on for a second. I'm feeling kind of inadequate now that I know that John Ottinger is John Ottinger III. So from now on, can I be Sam Sykes I?
I don't see why not.
All right, well, thank you.
I'm not going to call you that.
You're going to call me that.
No, I'm not going to call you that.
All right, you can call me Sam Sykes I, or you can call me by my romance writer name, Lance Mandrill.
Okay, that I can handle.
I thought that was, isn't that your porno name?
Have you been talking to George Martin?
No, George Martin will not take my calls.
Ah, well. If you have anything to say about football, he probably will.
Or vampire detectives? Was it vampire detectives or something? Or?
Is he into that?
I thought there wasn't there a vampire book.
I don't know. I don't think he's ever done vampires, but
Fever Dream was vampires.
Vampires. But that was vampires before vampires were big, right?
Yes, definitely. That was definitely vampires before vampires were big.
All right.
So, Sam, you have a book out right now. I believe it's a sparkly young adult thriller called Tome of the Underworld or Undergate or something, right?
Tome of the Undergates, yes.
And that's for kids and families.
That is for kids, families. It's been a real big hit with nuns. And a few Republican senators have really enjoyed it.
Now, we don't get into politics on this.
All right. No, I'm kidding.
We don't talk about politics, religion, or barbecue because we all know those are the three subjects that really just polarize people. And that's why, you know, we keep that off the podcast. We do not mention the fact that Texas barbecue sucks. So.
Oh. Okay.
If John DiNardo were on here, I think he'd disagree with us. Quite vehemently, actually.
But he's not here tonight. So, Sam, tell us what it's like to create a book with a character named Link.
Because
I keep wanting to say Link.
Well, now it's pretty nice because it's only four letters and people can pronounce it. And that's one of the big allures of that particular name. Because often in fantasy you find, I think if you have less than three syllables in your name, you're not taken seriously. But, you know, it's I really have no idea how to respond to that. No one's ever actually brought up the name. Like, I thought I was being clever there for a second, but...
I always try to ask questions that no one else asks. So I'll ask you one that probably some other people have asked you.
Okay.
What got you into this? What made you decide that you wanted to go down the road of rejection that eventually leads to a published novel?
I've never been rejected.
Never, ever?
I have a very good agent. And, you know, he handles the rejections for me. So I might have been rejected, but I don't know about it, so...
He shelters you.
He does. That's why he's good.
That's awesome.
Who's your agent?
My agent is Danny Barrore.
And obviously cool. He got good. You published through Pyre.
Yeah, Pyre was the last publisher to pick us up after a bunch of international countries, including... And international publishers, including Gallants.
Very so cool. Were you originally published, this is John, were you originally published overseas then, before you made it to the U.S.?
Yeah, I was published in the U.K. first, and then France and Germany, and then Canada, and then Holland, and then finally the U.S.
Canada doesn't count.
Canada counts.
Hey.
I just like to look
it out for you, Aiden.
Thank you.
And so you know, what's it like having your book published in all these other countries? I mean, obviously they're doing translations. Do you have any hand in that? I mean, do they come to you and say, "What does this mean?" so they can translate it into like German?
No, I talk with Emmanuel. He's translating my book into French. And he hasn't had any questions so far, but he's been really enthusiastic about it. So that's about as best as I can hope for.
He's French?
Yeah, he's French.
He hasn't given up yet?
He has. Oh, come on.
Oh.
God damn. We are just going to offend every country tonight. I don't even want to talk about the German edition now.
Aiden, did you have a question?
Who's your French publisher, Sam?
Fleuve Noir.
There's just been a ton of great cover art out of France lately, which I'm sure you won't be surprised to hear me say. And I just can't wait to see what they do with your book.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it too. But it won't be out in France and Germany until next year, I believe.
Now, who did the cover art for the Pyre cover?
Paul Young is the artist's name. He did the cover art for Pyre, Gallants, and Anchor in Canada, as well as Minx in Holland.
It's a pretty sweet cover.
I like it a lot. It's very blue. I mean, that's how you can tell its quality.
Blue, huh?
Well, the bluer a cover is, you know, the more seriously you need to take it.
gotcha.
Right. So by comparison, then, Star Wars The Force Unleashed 2 is like the Mac Daddy of all books right now. Has anybody seen that one yet?
No.
The cover on that? Oh, my word, it's so blue, it's not even funny. Not quite as blue as Tome of the Undergates. It's a darker blue, but it's blue.
Well, now, are you implying that you would not normally take Star Wars seriously?
I'm not implying that so much as I'm implying that game-based ones, novels, I take it seriously.
Yeah, I can't comment. I've only seen trailers for Force Unleashed 2, and from what I can gather, it's a story about a man who explodes a lot.
You know, my mom got very excited and had to call me to tell me that George Lucas has announced that he's going to put Star Trek in 3D.
Star Wars?
No, no. This is my mom. She said Star Trek.
She said Star Trek.
And I said, really? George Lucas is going to make Star Trek in 3D? She says, yes. Aren't you excited? And I said, sure. Yes.
She clearly wanted you to be excited, and she wanted you to think she was cool. So, you know, good on you for not calling her out on it. Unless you did.
No, I absolutely let her go. Tell us a little bit about the book, though. I mean, you know, part of this is trying to get people to go out there and buy the book. Right. Supposedly, you were like the most aggressive booth person at in Australia, you know, just trying to get that book sold and beat everybody else at the booth, at the Pyre booth.
Well, no, I wasn't in. We were in Atlanta.
I thought it was in Australia.
No.
Oh, Dragon Con. That's
Why
right.
Why do you think that?
I don't know.
You have Atlanta listeners right now who are turning this off.
No.
Because they take so much offense to being mistaken with Australia.
You know what? I've been to Atlanta. The first time I ever went to Atlanta, I had to drive on the bypass.
Right.
And I had to follow a guy up to like Gainesville and from that's, way down south.
That's a long drive. It's like 2 hours.
And he did it in 45 minutes.
You know, that can't be possible.
I was trying to do 55 and he was doing like 90. And so I sped up to 70 and police officers were passing me, yelling at me, telling me to go faster.
Huh.
I mean, it was just insane. Just insane.
When was that? I was raised up in Atlanta, as they say. This is John. Raised up in Atlanta, as they say.
This would have been 2000, 2001.
Golly. And they cracked down. It's 55 miles an hour around that place. And they cops there, man, they love pulling you over if you go over 55.
Everybody was going just gangbusters. Anyway, so you were I guess there was some sort of competition that you had created.
Yeah, I was the man who invented that competition, and I think I won because I was the only one who was playing. So, I wouldn't say I was aggressive. I was just, you know, if someone was looking at our books, I asked them what they liked, and if it sounded like something... If it sounded like they were looking for Tome of the Undergates or something like it, I recommended it to them, you know, and I didn't force it into their hands or anything. I only hit one person with a copy. So, you know, and you know, he was a dick, so.
Well, again, to kind of get back to the original point of that question, right. You tell us a little bit about the book. I mean, you know, you've got a captive audience here.
Okay, well, that's
enough. Let's move on.
Okay. Tome of the Undergates it's an adventure story. It has six people on an adventure to keep shut the gates of hell. And, you know, that might be something that sounds like you've heard something like it before, but these are characters that I would say have not been seen in fantasy for maybe a long time, maybe ever. I wrote them with the distinct question, why would anyone be an adventurer? Because when I was a kid, you know, I read a lot of Dragonlance, a lot of Forgotten Realms, like I'm sure a lot of people have.
Sure.
And it seemed to me that adventurers was a nice way of saying... sociopath, because all they did was go into a place where they weren't wanted, kill someone, and take their stuff. So I figure and somehow they come back and they're revered as heroes. So I asked, why would anyone do this in the first place? Why would anyone think they were heroes? And what would keep them doing this? And that question is as much part of the book as the actual quest to keep shut the gates of hell. It's all about the characters. You know, and they're not necessarily good, but they're gritty, but in a very human way. They're not always competent. They're not always heroic. They're frequently practical, occasionally racist, and watching them overcome that and seeing how their sort of flaws bind them together is sort of what the book is all about. That and the gates of hell and crotch stomping and everything else in there.
Do you are you looking at this as a single standalone story, or are you going to make a trilogy out of it? What are your
plans? No, it's a trilogy.
Okay.
The second book, Black Halo, is already done, and we should have media galleys or arcs from Pyre early next month.
Very cool. Very cool.
Out of curiosity, what is it about fantasy and the trilogy?
I don't know. You know, it's sort of like, I think it goes to the idea of a play in three acts. Like, if you want something epic, you need to set up the world in the first act and then set up the conflict in the second act. And finally, you bring it all down in the third act. Maybe not set up the conflict, but, you know, raise the stakes in the second act.
Aiden, don't knock it, because, I mean, he could have said, you know, oh, well, this is going to be the first of 22 novels.
This is true. Full of Brandon Sanderson, right? 10,000-page novels.
Well, come on now. Everyone likes Brandon Sanderson.
Yeah, I think Brandon is great. He stepped into shoes that I don't think anybody else would have particularly wanted to, given the same situation.
Yeah, I like how you say would have. Could
have. Well, I mean, you know, that's a tough gig, and I feel for him.
I want to pose a counter question here. Is like, what is it about fantasy readers that more than three books is like asking too much? Because the way I've always looked at it, if the story is fun and, you know, it's making progress in each book, then what's the harm if it goes on a little longer? Like, I won't deny there are frequently series that just have books that do absolutely nothing and just meander through the world, and clearly those aren't that great, but
it depends on. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking that. You made the point yourself, is that enough of them have been the most popular series, have had one or two books in it that have meandered and done nothing. And so people get burned out on that, and they only remember the last book they read, and if it happened to be that particular book. And then you get all this bad publicity, and then the next book comes out, it's really great. So.
What the heck was that?
All right, a little emphasis there. But yeah.
I would also throw out there, I mean, when you talk about, you know, fantasy readers, and I think science fiction readers, this applies a little bit to them as well. You know, a lot of times when you read something really, really good, you don't want it to end.
Yeah.
So you want that next book. Or at least you want to be able to, you know, continue on with those characters that you've come to enjoy.
Right.
But there is the point where you go, oh, dear Lord, what are you doing?
Yeah, well, there comes a point where there's just nothing more to say.
Faith of the Fallen.
Oh. Well.
Hey, Faith of the Fallen is good. Naked Empire is where it jumped the shark.
Yeah, right. Yeah, absolutely. Naked Empire is where it totally lost it. Actually, though, I think I would go as far back as after Blood of the Fold, you're pretty much done with the story.
So yeah. More or less, yeah. The Empire comes in, and then things start going downhill at that point.
Yeah, well, point being, like, when it has nothing more to say, the audience clearly knows it. And ideally, the author should know it, too, and that's when it's time to move on to something else.
Well, and
out of curiosity, how much of that is from publisher pressure? You know, when a series does take off, like Terry Goodkind's, like Robert Jordan's, is there pressure from the publishers to...
I do not doubt that publisher pressure plays into it a lot. I've never had that from my publishers, clearly, because I just came out. But, you know, the publisher... I was going to say the publisher has no power. Like, they can't make an author write something he doesn't want to. But then I remembered the publisher does have the power to offer a lot of money, which...
Sure.
Which is, you know, it's a pretty good power to have.
Well, and, you know, from the author's perspective, obviously they want to, you know, continue writing and right. pushing out books. From the publisher's perspective, obviously they're going to want something that is popular and that people are going to buy. You know, of course they are.
Something true, tried and true.
But there's also, you know, I hearken back to someone like Mike Resnick, who will write stories set in the same universe, just not necessarily the same characters. You know, and that can work too.
Yeah, well, it's worked for Joe Abercrombie. Mm-hmm. So
exactly.
That's actually one of my favorite
types. Many authors over time. Go ahead, Aiden. Sorry.
That's actually just one of my favorite types of storytelling. Actually, guys like Joe Abercrombie and even you know, old time Terry Brooks did that very well, writing in one universe, few crossover characters, few crossover plot lines, but mostly standalone stories.
Do you guys mind if I change gears a moment?
No. Go right ahead, John.
And Sam, I had a very specific question for you in the fact that in your novel, you basically set up two significant battles in Tome of the Undergates.
Right.
And you actually do your world building and characterization in the framework of the battle, a lot of it. Obviously, that was a conscious decision. Was there fear that this might be a problem for publishers or readers? Because it is an unusual sort of way of doing things. Most people like their battles done and over with. Make them real exciting and let it go.
Well, to counterpoint the idea that most people like their battles done and over with, R.A. Salvatore is something like one of the highest paid fantasy authors out there. And I think he does probably a lot more battle than I do. There was some trepidation as to whether or not people would actually get behind this. But I think, you know, in the end, it was going to be a matter of they either dig it or they don't. And that's pretty much been Tome entirely. You know, all throughout the book, they either like it or they don't. But I feel the decision fits pretty well because it's a violent world. These are people who, by profession, are violent. And, you know, their characters come out in fighting, which is what they do a lot. It's a world based in conflict. I saw no reason why we couldn't just characterize people in conflict.
And to, you know, to kind of tie this with something that we were talking about last night, the topic for the little mini mind melds that we do before the interview.
Right.
Was about morally ambiguous characters.
Right.
And that seems to be more mainstream today versus in the past.
Like,
in other words, there's no, you know, there's no absolute white hat, absolute black hat.
Well, that's still pretty popular. I mean, you know, like, Aiden, you said yourself, Spellwright and Peter V. Brett's novels have all worked well off the clearly defined good, clearly defined evil. So I'd say that's still viable out there. But I've had a lot of thoughts about the term morally ambiguous, because moral ambiguity means good and bad in the same, you know, all in the same stew of a character. Whereas I think lately we're sort of moving towards moral ambiguity, meaning that everyone is a dick. So you don't really, it's like you see there's no more black and white, but there is black and blacker. And very few people seem, you know, there are some instances where few characters seem all that compelled or, you know, even in conflict with themselves. They just do the wrong thing without thinking. Mm-hmm. And that's not quite moral ambiguity.
No, but you know, you think about the rogue or the Han Solo kind of character who appears to be very not dark, but you know he's Han Solo and he's only in it for the money. But then you know, gosh, he has the heart of gold and he does the right thing in the end.
You relate that to Dungeons and Dragons, and that would be the what they always call the chaotic good character.
Exactly.
I don't know, Sam, if you played at all.
A little. Not as much as people accuse me of, but I had a hard time sitting still through it because I did not like other people doing things that I didn't want to do. But, yeah, you know, there is that. I think, you know, at the risk of seeming too nerdy, I think that's a pretty good...
There's no such thing as too nerdy.
Right. Not on Functional Nerds.
No. And no. Actually, this is for SF Signal, powered by the Functional Nerds.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Forgive me. But, you know, that's, you know, Han Solo was a conflicted character. You know, he was very much tempered by practicality. He wanted to make money and survive. But at the same time, he wanted to help out these people. And I think that inner conflict is what defines a lot of moral ambiguity and that idea of it's not good versus evil. Like, no one wakes up and decides, well, I think I'm going to be evil today. It's a matter of, you know, practicality versus desire, I think.
Sure. Well, I mean, there's doing the right thing, and then there's doing the right thing only because it falls in line with what you were going to do anyway.
Right. Right. Is
this a bit of situational ethics, I guess?
Could be.
Yeah, and ideally, you want the characters to be in situations where those conflicts come to light. So, you know, I guess what I'm saying is you need motive rather than, like, a code of ethics. You can't have people being evil for the sake of being evil because that's just ridiculous. And you can't have people being good for the sake of being good because who would do that?
Gotcha. Okay. Now, just out of curiosity, I mean, are you doing this full time now? Are you a full time writer, or do you still have a day job? Or
no, I'm a full time writer.
That's awesome. Good for you.
I do all right. So.
And let's see. You are, you know, obviously we've been chatting on Twitter a little bit.
Right.
I've been kind of. You know, just trying to pull you out of your shell a little bit on Twitter. You're so closed in, you hardly know what you're really thinking.
I know. I'm a very, very complex...
Introverted, stuff. Yes.
Yes. Actually, lately, you know, when I was on Twitter, it was all, you know, sexual threats and insults, but I've been trying not to threaten people so much because... I understand that's a turnoff. But then I threatened Brent Weeks like 2 days ago, so who knows?
And why do you do that?
I don't know, man. It's you know, it's Brent Weeks. He looks like you could take him in a fight.
He's a really nice guy, though.
He's nice, and he's been nothing but nice to me. And, you know, if he wasn't nice and if I didn't like him, I wouldn't try to mess with him. But... You know, since he is nice to me, I will gladly ask if his sister is hot.
Which he refused to answer that question, by the
way. Yeah, but, you know, we'll find out.
He said he was already in enough trouble for that.
Was he? Well, yes. I hope she doesn't listen to this. If she does, though, Brent Week's sister, are you hot?
So you're on Twitter. What's your Twitter so folks can find you and follow you?
I'm at Sam Sykes Swears.
Okay, and you got the website?
Yeah, samsykes.com, which I'm pretty pleased with. We've done a lot of neat work with it lately.
It looks pretty cool. What's with the Doctor Who scarf over your face?
My sister made that for me, you dick.
Is your sister hot?
My sister is so far beyond your league. She is like Captain Evil. My sister made that for me, and I cannot remember what possessed me to make that picture, but it was there, so that was the only picture I had, so I put it up.
Gotcha. And you've got a blog on there.
I've got a blog. I've got excerpts. I've got some various threats that people have made against me on the praise page.
You're very confrontational, aren't you, Sam?
I do not back down, even when there is nothing to back down from. In fact, I frequently am the source of that, of confrontation, when there is absolutely nothing to confront about.
Gotcha, gotcha. John, did you have any other questions?
No.
Aiden?
Yeah, actually, I have just one more that kind of ties back into the D&D subject.
Right.
you mentioned that you didn't really play a whole lot of D&D, which is has always kind of interested me as these younger writers are coming up, because you're hitting the first generation that probably spent more time playing video games than they did playing D&D. And I'm just curious if this is, you know, I know you're a gamer. Did that right. have any effect on you as a storyteller? Do you think it'll affect to the fantasy genre going forward and science fiction as well?
Yeah, that's kind of that's interesting. Because, you know, I don't mean to insult any other gamers, but a lot of video games are not all that well written.
No.
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 But, you are being going to be struck off. I'm serious. Be struck off.
Better than stroked off. But,
and there goes the explicit
tag. Probably.
Well, anyways.
All right, NSFW, there it goes.
All right, To answer that question, there, I think we have some things that we can do, learn from games, and some of those are how to do action in an interesting way, because, you know, a lot of the combat I read sort of flows like a technical manual, you know, like there's always feints and parries for some reason, which is kind of the most boring thing you could possibly describe, is someone moving slightly to the left. So I think, you know, if you wanted to see how to make something look interesting and how to describe it, you could probably do worse than, you know, playing God of War or something. I wouldn't say that you should try to learn other things from God of War. Like, you probably would be better off actually reading a book to figure out characterization and pacing and so forth. So, you know, I think it might influence some writers, but it probably won't. You know, we probably won't see a lot of people aspiring to be.
Now, what's your preference when it comes to gaming? Are you a console gamer or are you a PC gamer?
I have a Mac, so I'm a console gamer by default.
Very cool. So, yeah. World of Warcraft?
Oh, God.
Do you ever get sucked into that?
Like, you know, it's one of those falling off the wagon situations. I try not to play too much World of Warcraft because I get... You know, I get bored, and then I move into PvP, and, you know, no one is a good person when they play PvP. So, you know, it turns into less confrontational. Like, you know, there's no, is your sister hot? It's more like, if you don't cap the flag, I swear to God.
Yes.
I will find out if your sister is hot.
Yes. Yeah, PvP is. I got into PvP and all that kind of stuff for about 2 weeks when they first came out with the capture the flag type games, and got up to a sergeant or something like that. Then I just quit.
It turns people into monsters. Like, there is no two ways about it. And, you know, I don't mean that as condemnation. There is just absolutely no way to get into a game that revolves around you chasing down someone else and stabbing them in the face. That is an inherently monstrous thing to do. So.
Yes. Well, I was part of a hardcore role-playing guild. Now this is how I define hardcore. Here's how I do it. We were role-playing
with real
No. We were a role-playing guild we were raiding Molten Core, and we were role-playing while raiding Molten Core. So we were doing it in character. Okay. So we would have the raid chat. We would have the class chat. You know, so if you're a mage, you're in the mage chat. If you're a warrior, you're in the warrior chat. You know, blah blah blah. And then we would have the general chat where people could talk. And then we had a role playing chat. And we were keeping them all going at the same time. And when people found out that we were doing that and taking down Molten Core, they were going, "Who the hell are you people?"
I'm tempted to ask that myself. Just hearing it. If you can hardcore roleplay and PvP,
we had people.
I'll be impressed. If you can reliably roleplay someone who teabags another person in a convincing manner, I will be very impressed.
We knew people who were constantly flagged. Ha. That's just how they lived on the server.
That's how they roll.
Yep.
All right.
But that's like 2 years of my life that I'll never get back.
That's sort of the thing, isn't it? It just eats time, and you can't do anything about it.
And the other thing I didn't understand was every Canadian, and this is not a joke on you, Aiden, or anything. It's just every time I would meet someone who was Canadian, they were a hunter.
I was a hunter.
It was like, yeah, I don't.
I swear to God.
it just trips me out. It's like, oh, that's a really cool hunter. Hey, where do you live? Oh, I'm in Vancouver.
Huh. Well, I'm sure there are a lot of Canadian jokes we could make.
I don't know. Maybe there's just something about being a hunter that appeals to people.
There are a lot of real life hunters up here, so maybe that's it.
Maybe that's
we're just embracing our Canadianness.
I've never met a real life hunter for all the times I've been in Canada. They all seem.
I'm sure you have.
You want to go hunting when I go up to Surrey?
I don't know.
Do you want to play the most dangerous game?
I think we'll be hunted in Surrey.
That's true.
No, in city. But then, apologies, Surrey listeners.
Well, maybe we'll just hunt at the writers' conference then.
And that reminds me, do you have any appearances coming up? Are you going to World Fantasy?
I have an ass load of appearances. I'm at the Rincon Games in Tucson next weekend.
Okay.
Then I'm at the Surrey Internationals Writers Conference, which I think Aiden is going to be at.
Perhaps.
If he is, we'll see if I can hunt and track him like an animal.
I am a bagel.
Right. And then I'm at World Fantasy.
Okay.
Because I hear good things about it from Peter Brett and Blake Charlton.
Yep,
and you know, maybe Brent Weeks will be there, and maybe
he's not.
Oh, he's not?
No.
Oh, good. Good.
But I'll be there.
All right. Well, if he asks you to punch me on his behalf, I won't blame you if you try.
Well, I'll be there. John and Elia will be there. Some other folks from SF Signal are going to be there. So definitely, you know, we'll find you and say hello and.
Yeah, no, Scott Lynch convinced me to go, and if he's there, great. If not, so much better. But
I don't think Lou Anders is going. I don't think Lou Anders is going.
No, Lou Anders is not going, but I think he's doing something else. Lou Anders is a rough man to hang out with. Like, he called me a sissy because I wanted to go home. he said he like drank twice as much as me and would continue to do so, and that if I left then, because we were all at Dragon Con, if I left, I was a coward. So
this is starting to sound like I've heard some interviews with like the guys who were who would be in television shows with Bob Conrad.
Yeah, he's. It's an experience to be near him, because then he brought two cups of Guinness and I had to race him. And I lost. And you know that the next day he texted me, said, "Where are you?" I said, "I'm a little hungover. I think I'm going to be like an hour late." And he just texts back, "Wuss." I went to bed at 5 and I was up at 7.
Yes, we and we love Lou, and we love hearing stories about Lou.
Yeah, awesome guy, but God, I threatened to fight, to fist fight a lot of people, but probably not Lou.
Alrighty, well, I think we better wrap this up. Again, Sam Sykes, and the book is Tome of the Undergates.
Yep.
It's available through Pyre. You can get it on Amazon.com and probably any of your local bookstores.
Right.
And then you said the second book, do you have a date for that to come out?
The second book, Black Halo, should be out probably early next year from Pyre. And then it was slated to come out in October of 2011 in the UK, but since we finished it, we might be pushing it up.
Okay.
But you know, I have no say in that. That's a publisher thing.
Any anthologies, short stories, novellas, flash fiction coming out?
No, I'm in the Dragons book, but that's been a while back. No, pretty much it's just the Aeon's Gate trilogy right now that I'm working on.
Okay.
So.
Well, very cool. Well, thanks for coming on, Sam.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. Signal.